Hi, I'm Lukman Haris. You are watching a very special episode of Agenda Awani, broadcasting from the sidelines of the International Social Wellbeing Conference 2023 with the theme of changing the game, building the world we want. If there's one priority that this government has, or in fact the previous governments before it, is to increase well-being, social protection and generally improving the quality of life for Malaysians, largely through economic means. This is the mantra, this is the goal of many different governments before and also this current government. But of course, it's easier said than done. The issue is very broad, multifaceted. Many challenges lie before us. And this is essentially what this conference aims to talk about and tackle and find solutions to. And also, this is the topic and focus of our episode today. I'm joined by three distinguished gentlemen who are experts in this field. Beside me is Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, Professor of Economics from Boston University. Dr. Stephen Kidd is a senior social policy analyst for Development Pathways, a leading consultancy in designing and developing social protection systems. And also Nur Hisham Hussein is the Chief Strategy Officer for the Employees Provident Fund, or EPF. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Pleasure. I'd like to start with Hisham. Hisham, so one of the focus of your session just now was generally providing a better quality of life for Malaysians, as we've mentioned. This is a very broad and multifaceted goal. So what are the challenges we face in achieving it?
Well, you know, the problem with having multifaceted and broad challenges, it requires multifaceted and broad answers.
Yeah.
Right? But, you know, let's break it down in terms of social protection. There's two particular areas that we need to be concerned about. One is, do we have everybody in the system? In other words, the coverage. And second is, are the benefits that we provide adequate? Right? And we have different levels of, I think, achievement in these areas. I think coverage is probably more important because there's a ways to go, I think, in terms of achieving adequacy, I think, in terms of benefits that we provide to people. If we can get everybody covered in the first place, then, you know, just being able to provide some assistance is better than nothing at all. Mm-hmm. Versus what we have today, where we have lots of gaps. So most of the systems that we have, EPF, SOCSO, are geared towards the formal sector. In other words, somebody who actually gets a paycheck every month, right? If you don't, then you can join the system voluntarily, but very, very few people actually do that. So we exclude roughly about 50% of the workforce from any kind of social protection, simply because they're not earning a monthly wage.
Right.
And so I think that is the first and biggest challenge that we need to overcome. And after that, I think we can start looking at whether the benefits that are provided are actually adequate.
Right. We'll explore that a bit further, but I want to go to Dr. Kidd. Doctor, social protection in developing countries can be tricky because developing economies such as Malaysia, we have limited financial capacities, to put it simply. So in Malaysia, for example, what's the balance to be struck between helping those in need and ensuring that the country's financial position remains healthy and unpressured?
Right. I think it's quite a big question. I think we're always told that there's limited financial capacities in countries. People talk about fiscal constraint. I think a fiscal constraint is really just another term for a political constraint, and that you have governments that are perhaps unwilling to expand the fiscal space because they're unwilling to present to the population, look, to get better public services, we've got to have more tax, we've got to have more revenues. And it's kind of that fear of going out and presenting that case. So generally, it's not necessarily a fiscal constraint. There's lots of opportunities to expand the fiscal space in Malaysia. I was talking to people, the top rate of tax is income tax, 32%. Well, I pay a lot more than that, right, in my tax. So there's no fiscal constraint to put the top rate of tax to my level. Mm-hmm. It's a political constraint, right? Which government's going to be brave enough to say, hey, let's raise the income tax? And then a lot of it then comes down to, okay, why are people wanting to pay tax and not wanting to pay tax? And the basic problem is people don't trust governments. And if you don't trust your government, then you're not going to be willing to pay your tax. So governments have to increase trust in themselves, and then people will be more willing to pay more tax, and then they'll be more willing, and then governments will have greater revenues. So how do you build trust and overcome the higher level of that? And that, I think, I was talking earlier today, is about beginning to put in place universal public services, right? That's how you build a strong social contract between people. You pay your taxes and you get high quality public services in back. And that's what Europe did after the Second World War,
yep.
where they had very low tax rates, right? At the end of the Second World War, right? Similar to Malaysia, but then started building a system based off around universal social security, promising everybody old age pensions, child benefits, disability benefits, built trust, and gradually people began to pay more tax. I think you take a long-term vision. It's about how do you build a stronger social contract in Malaysia, build the trust of people so that governments can then say, hey, we'll give you better public services in exchange for greater tax. And that's the kind of major change that high-income countries managed to shift after the Second World War, after the crisis of the Second World War. And that's the fundamental constraint that's there. So I don't buy this that it's a fiscal constraint. I think it's a political constraint.
Yeah, talking about political expediency, we've seen a lot of politically expedient policies here, politically expedient economic policies here in Malaysia, as we have with many in many different countries. Professor Kotlikov, Malaysia has a very high subsidy bill, for example. We keep heavily subsidizing things, amongst others, because it's a very politically popular thing to do. We also are continuing the policy of cash handouts. It's been quite a few years. So considering the country's financial position and the economic state of the population, what's the feasibility of continuing these policies in the long run?
Well, looking at it from a comparison with US and European countries, I'd say, to begin with, Malaysia's doing a lot of things much better, okay? Dramatically better. For example, if I understand it correctly, you have a provident fund where people are putting with their employer together about 25% of their wages into saving for old age. Now, that's their own money being invested as opposed to their money being given to their parents and grandparents and hoping that their kids will pay them. That's a pay-as-you-go Ponzi scheme, kind of a scam, where you're promised something, but you may not be able to deliver. So our system in our country is completely bankrupt when you look at the data, to the point where we need to raise payroll taxes by about 40%. To keep the thing going. The payroll tax is already about 12.4%. So we do have, you might think we have some leverage or some scope there, but we have lots of other taxes. You have a pretty low income tax for most households, except the very high income. So you have very good incentives to work. So what you don't want to do is replicate what the West has done, because the West has screwed it up dramatically. We have people locked into poverty because they're being given benefits, that's the good thing, but then if they earn money, they lose them. So you can have people, and this is partly because we have 51 different fiscal systems in all the different states and Washington, D.C. So it's actually easy for somebody to be in a 100% marginal tax bracket. We have people in a 20,000% marginal tax bracket. They earn another $1,000, they lose healthcare benefits, food benefits, housing benefits, childcare benefits, and then they also have to pay taxes. So the whole thing, we would be happy to have the Malaysian system. I think the big issue is what my colleague here is indicating, that the coverage, getting everybody into the formal sector, you really have a very good system right now. You just need to get inclusion, and you need to continue to, with your provident fund, you're making clear that it's your money being invested wisely with a good return, and you'll get it back. So it's not felt as a tax, it's felt as, you know, so this linkage is very important, and getting people in the informal sector to fully understand that, but also not to give them an option to be out of the formal sector the Chinese do this, that's the last thing I'll say real quickly, from what I gather, and other countries are, by eliminating cash transactions so that everybody's income, their contributions are, their income is immediately recorded because there's no cash transactions, and they're immediately, you know, making contributions to the Provident Fund or other funds and getting back benefits. And it's, you know, it seems to be working.
So how much of that is, because some people I think in the States will say that my money is my money. The state can't dictate how much I save, how much I save up in my retirement fund. So in terms of Malaysia as well, I mean, we have policies, I mean, Provident Funds aside, like as I mentioned, we've had policies of cash handouts. We've had, we still continue to have very heavy subsidizing of things. The extreme polar opposite of what's happening in the States would be, say, a welfare state. So many are saying that if these policies continue in Malaysia, it's a slippery slope to becoming a welfare state, to people becoming too dependent on the state to give them cash handouts, to give subsidies on everything. So where do you think the balance is in the case of Malaysia?
Well, just my quick review suggests people are being forced to save, and that is a good thing. And they're being forced to save in a pretty reasonable way. I mean, I would modify some of the investment opportunities, but and people in Asia generally are good savers. So having this like low-cost way of saving in a diversified manner, something you should be saving anyway, that's a great thing. And not relying on your kids, that's really a big plus. Compared to, I mean, people really need to look at the rest of the world that's developed, so-called developed, and see how they've screwed it up. And take pride in the fact that it's been done well in Malaysia by many different governments. And understand that there's a cohesion of policy, even though there seems to be differences. So I think that, you know, and you also have a federal system. You don't have 51 different states with their own fiscal policies in effect. So I think there's great advantages. I would not view being forced to save in a good way with my own account and getting a very good return as some kind of slippery slope.
So economically, you favor centralization?
I think, well, not in every country. You know, Russia's centralized, and they're screwing it up. Russia has a 30% payroll tax, and the money's being... Right. Nobody has any idea that they're going to get anything back. So it really depends on, you know, who's running, who's, whether people are managing things well.
Yeah.
Seems like the EPF is managing things very well.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that just because they invited me to your lovely country.
Because you've got the EPF backdrop behind you there. So.
I would say exactly the opposite if it were not true.
Right. So it's interesting what you said that... the generation that depends on their kids. So we have this in Malaysia, we call them the sandwich generation. I mean, people who have to support their kids and also their parents as well. But coming back to your point, Hisham, about those who are left behind, those who are in the informal sector. So what is EPF's plan to ensure that everyone is on board, to make sure that everyone in the informal sector is also part of this group who are covered, who are saving for their retirement?
First thing we have to do is obviously education, right? We have to reach out to people and say, okay, we have this mechanism for you to save, right? You do have to think about your future because it's ultimately your responsibility.
You want to keep it as voluntary.
Yeah, but we kept it as voluntary because it's not within the current legal framework for us to make it mandatory. Now, we hope to be able to do that, but there will still continue to be groups of people who probably not still fall under a legal definition of a worker. A housewife, for example. If a housewife isn't working, right, she doesn't fall as an employee. You can't exactly cover her under the EPF Act, right? So we continue to have certain groups of people who continue to be voluntary. But what we're trying to do today is actually making it easier for people to save, as well as providing them the education, the tools, the ability to actually make plans for their future, we're the platform for them to do it in. So part of the agenda for this conference. So next tomorrow, the PM will be giving the keynote address, but he'll be also launching the second iteration of our app. Mm-hmm. So the app will allow for a lot more interaction between ourselves and our members, and hopefully it'll be a step further in terms of building those voluntary savings.
How do you keep track, though? For example, taking your example of a housewife.
Yeah.
Currently, the system is your paycheck is XXX amount, and it will take X percentage of that amount. So a housewife, for example, how do you keep track of that?
Well, we're not going to go on a basis of percentage. I mean, you're not going to get a wage, right? Yeah. So you do have what we call a voluntary contribution limit. So on a yearly basis, you can put in 100,000 ringgit, up to 100,000 ringgit. Now, we encourage people to put up to as much as they can up to that limit. But the reality, I think, for most people, they don't earn that much. So we just encourage them to save as much as they can.
Yep. So Dr. Kit, so essentially there's two different systems here helmed by EPF, which is the we are forced to actually save our money. People who work office jobs, for example, have a steady paycheck, and those in the informal sector who are more on a volunteer basis. So which one, to put it simply, which one do you think would be more efficient and effective, the forced way or the voluntary way?
So I think we've got to look at the question a lot more. I don't think it's either or. That's only a tiny part of the solution. What's the big problem in Malaysia? What proportion of over 65s get a pension in Malaysia? 18%. 82% of Malaysians don't have access to an old age pension. So I think the EPF, you know, it's a great institution. I think it's great the EPF is actually generating new thinking in Malaysia. But they know the EPF also needs to reform and be part of a multi-tiered system, right? And I think you'll find the institution most pushing for a tax finance pension in Malaysia is the EPF, right? Right. There's a tax finance pension where you just pay it out of tax. It's your perfect pay-as-you-go. It's not a Ponzi scheme. It's a pay-as-you-go pension. Your people paying their taxes throughout their lives, and then you get your pension when you reach retirement age. And it's paid for from current pensioners. So the UK is just reforming its pension system. We'll reach a kind of flat rate pension for everybody in the UK. And it's interesting, where do you find the lowest levels of old age poverty in the world? New Zealand. What kind of pension system does New Zealand have? Flat rate pension paid for out of general taxation. How do you qualify? You live for 7 years in New Zealand and you qualify for a flat rate pension. And they have a contributory system on top of that, right? For those who can contribute, they do more. And it's important for it to have a mandatory element to that because young people won't recognize it. Yes. You want more, so you're going to have a mandatory element. But you have to have a multi-tiered system. You can't have a society where 80% of older people in an aging society like Malaysia are without pensions. That's going to cause you massive problems down the line. And there's lots of pension system designs that you can have. Mm-hmm. And the EPF is going to be very much part of the solution to that. But realistically, many of those in the informal economy, the only pension they're ever going to get is one that's funded out of general taxation,
right,
which means you've got to increase your tax revenues. And I think that the sort of whole question I think you were posing before about you might become a welfare state. I'm pretty convinced if a Malaysian, if you went to live in Finland and you got a decent job in Finland working the same job, but they've got their welfare state. There's no Finns are complaining about the welfare state in Finland. That's the state that they want to live in, right? They think it's fantastic. Who's complaining about it? I'd love to live in Finland. I'm sure you'd love to live in Finland. We'd all love to live in a Finnish system. We pay higher taxes, but we have a higher quality of life, a higher standard of living. You know, it comes at the cost of more taxes, but we're willing to pay more. They have higher salaries as well than many other countries in the world. They're the happiest country in the world. I think we've got to be very careful when we say, hey, we don't want a welfare state, because a lot of people are living in really well-designed welfare or social security states, are very, very happy to live there. What I found, I was talking to a Norwegian once. I said, why is nobody from Norway? Why don't I find them in the World Bank office in Washington? Why nobody from Norway there? And I was talking to a Norwegian, said, hey, there's nobody in Norway who wants to go to live in Washington. Why on earth is a Norwegian going to move to Washington? That's why we've got so few there.
The Norwegians have a huge amount of wealth in
yes.
the North Sea,
yes.
a huge provident fund, and they're paying a lot of benefits to people. So they're a rich country. They're like Brunei,
yes.
right? So I think we differ dramatically about, fundamentally about what's good policy here going forward. Do you want to match, or do you want to end up kind of gradually moving to what Western Europe, most of Western Europe, and the U.S. are doing, or do you want to kind of continue your success formula while including more and more people? So I see what you're doing is linking people's tax, quote, taxes, they're really contributions to what they're getting out. So they don't view this as a work disincentive. Hey, it's my money. Mm. Now, if you talk about wives, for example, non-working wives are staying home to bring up children, you can have the government take a portion of the husband's, take the contribution and divide it 50-50. So the wife has an equal size account as the husband. And then now you have the wife fully participating. In the case of a divorce, they walked away with the same size account. You can have the government provide matching contributions on behalf of the poor to their own personal account. You have personal accounts in effect here. You can have the government provide matching contributions. You have the government contribute on the behalf of the disabled and the unemployed. So that gets everybody in the Provident Fund. Everybody's participating. You have, I mean, think about, you do have state-provided health insurance, so that is, you know, a form of tax-paid benefits. It's very hard to connect, you know, your contribution to your own health care. Obviously, it's because what you're going to get is very random. But you are paying for insurance, so people kind of don't view that as a tax. And that's working. So if you look at, you know, the big problem in Malaysia, it's really the coverage. It's really getting people in the informal sector. And I wouldn't give them the option. I would say, we're going to record what you're making, what you're earning, because we're going to move cash out of the system. We're going to give you incentives to and give you the equipment, the modern technology to take in money and you know, electronically to take, you know, just like they do in China, just like you cannot buy anything in Beijing without an iPhone, without a cell phone, right? Should be the same thing here. Should gradually, quickly move in that direction. And now you'll have everybody included, and you will have, you know, look, Singapore is a great success story with a Provident Fund. You know, we would be so much better off had we followed that model in the U.S. We're going to be in a position where we're going to have to take our PAYGO system, which is really a Ponzi scheme, and switch it to a Provident-type fund at great loss to young and middle-aged people who've been promised X and they'll get Y because the system is so broke. Do not follow our example.
Ready to actually compel people in the informal sector to contribute to their retirement savings, people like housewives, like Professor mentioned just now. And also number two is, what do you think the challenge is in increasing awareness and increasing basically the desire of these people in the informal sector to contribute to their funds?
So just to answer the first question, actually, Prof, we actually have a very similar product to that where we call it ISAYA. So out of the 11% contribution from the husband, we take 2% and give it to the wife. and
should be 5.5%.
The problem is some people can have up to four wives, so we have to make sure that it's fair.
That's a uniquely Malaysian, I guess.
It's a uniquely Malaysian problem. Yeah. So yeah. we can only take 2% because that way we can divide it up equally, right?
Right, that's interesting.
Four wives.
Yes.
Well,
that's right.
I would say the husband should get his. It should be there's five people. He should get a fifth.
Yeah.
That's the answer.
Roughly.
He may not want to have so many wives.
Yes.
But that would be equality of treatment of women, and you have, the economy is dependent on female labor force participation, which is low. I think it's about 58%.
Yes, it is low.
Male, it's about 80%. It needs to be increased.
Yeah.
Women need to understand that they, when they go to work, that they will get, even though some part of it was being taken away for the Provident Fund, really a very high share. Yeah. It's 25% when you include the employer contribution, but that's giving them real assets. So people should be getting statements all the time.
Yeah.
This is my holdings in the Provident Fund.
Yeah.
And the Provident Fund should be investing abroad as well as domestically. It should not be a conduit for the government to borrow money.
Yeah, of course.
Okay? So, you have 40% of the Provident Fund invested in fixed income securities. My guess is most of that's government bonds. My view is that none of it should be in government bonds.
Right.
Let Malaysians invest in Singapore government bonds, and American government bonds, and British government bonds, but not in effect fund deficit financed by the Malaysian government. Mm. But they should also be invested in we have 6,000 stocks in the US, companies, big companies, small companies, they should be invested in the US stock market, the British stock market, the German stock market. And then they should see, hey, I have wealth all over the world.
Yeah.
And they should have that report every month.
Mm.
Now they'll really understand going to work has a real payoff.
Yep.
Because you're already there, you just have to advertise with the great things you're doing.
Yeah. Right. So to get back to your question, I think as far as making it mandatory, I think one, the education has to happen, right? It's not something you can do overnight and compel people to do overnight. I think SOXO shifted to a mandatory model for the informal sector about 3 years ago, but they're taking it step by step because you have to educate the members, you have to educate the employers.
And it helps that SOXO deductions are very small compared to EPF
Whereas EPF is much larger. Yeah. So we have to take it a bit slower, I think, in terms of creating that mandatory coverage. But I think the ambition is eventually we'll get there because, we have to do it, right? I think the challenge of really reaching out to people, we do know that... I just did my regional rounds a couple of months ago, and Malaysia is so diverse, right? There are parts where, having a smartphone is fine. It's common. Klang Valley, Johor, Penang, very easy. But once you start getting out of those areas, right, banking penetration is low. Not everybody has an account. Not everybody has a debit card. So it's still very much a cash economy. And that makes things a lot harder.
So the policy should be to give everybody a debit card, give everybody a phone, and give everybody, make your Provident Fund not just a savings account, but also a checking account. Give everybody a debit card on their Provident Fund checking account, because we'd have two accounts.
Yeah.
So I'm agreeing with, the general idea that there's some people, you need to have basic benefits for people who cannot contribute because they're disabled, they're just unable to work and make it in society. So they do need these. Here's where the taxes and the transfers have to occur.
Yeah.
But otherwise, this linkage, getting everybody in, having, well-designed forced saving, forced insurance, forced disability insurance, forced life insurance to protect kids, where everybody sees that, hey, this is not a tax, this is not an incentive to stay out of the formal system. This is a way to have protection for my kids and for myself. And this is the only real way, and that this is you know, very transparent. That's the great advantage. That's the drive. I think you have a great model. I mean, look at Malaysian per capita GDP growth is one of the highest in the world. It's 5% on average or so over the last few decades. And you don't want to kill the baby with the bathwater, right?
Yeah. Right.
So I think we basically fundamentally agree. It's more the engineering of how, I think we all three agree that we're, you know, social insurance is critical and that some people are not going to be able to, you know, be contributing on their own. They have to be taken care of. So there has to be a floor. So it's like New Zealand is giving maybe a low benefit, and then you've got private contribution, private voluntary participation. But voluntary participation doesn't work in a lot of countries. In the U.S., we have a voluntary retirement account system, 401k, it's called. Yep. Nobody contributes. We have people coming, baby boomers, coming into retirement. The average, the median wealth in those accounts is $120,000. That's about 3 years of spending, maybe 2 or 3 years of spending. People are going to be broke. They're going to be going to poverty. So we started out with like a 20-25% poverty rate of the elderly. Went down to 12% when we took from the young and gave to the old in this pay-go. And now it's going to go back up because we have it's either we're going to bankrupt the kids or bankrupt the parents.
Dr. Do you want to get to weigh in on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would agree. Nobody wants to follow the United States model, right? I think we can agree. But we also say, right, Norway's got a sovereign wealth fund, very wealthy. Finland doesn't, Denmark doesn't, Sweden doesn't, but they still have similar levels of wealth. What's Denmark got? A few fish? Well, Malaysia's got a few fish. Malaysia's got oil as well. How did Norway build its sovereign wealth fund? It didn't have a massive fuel subsidy, right, to be able to put that money into a sovereign wealth fund, right? In the UK, we take our oil from the same sea, we put in the tax cuts. Now we have nothing, right? We wish we'd been Norway, right? There's different ways of even managing your oil to actually create it for the future. But I think it is, the important thing is the, you know, you need a mixed system, right? I think that's what we're saying. You have to have benefits. One way of doing it, though, I think, which we forget about, is what's mandatory in many high-income countries and started in the United States in 1870, in Belgium in 1919, is the mandatory declaration of your incomes on an annual basis, right? That's critical. If you want to formalize, you have to know people's incomes. You have to make people declare those incomes on an annual basis. Until you're willing to do that and able to do that, then it becomes a challenge. You don't even know where people are. Now, how can you do that? You know, because people don't want to declare their incomes because they're worried about being taxed. So one idea, you know, I've been trying to promote, many countries provide universal child benefits, right? So your right as a citizen to give it for your child. What if you were to make every family gets a child, every family can child benefits for their children, but only if you declare your income that year. You declare your income, then you can get the benefits of the universal child benefits, your rights and responsibilities. Then you might get a lot of people coming into the...
That's a terrific idea.
Into the tax system through an incentive base. Once they're in, perhaps you don't want to be taxing them immediately. You put your income tax rate a bit high. Yeah. But once people get used to it, then you can begin to incorporate the tax base. Then you can get them into the EPF. Then you can get them into SOCSEC. Then you can do that. But people have to get this custom of doing it. And Malaysia's on the cusp of becoming a high-income country. What you need is this mandatory declaration of incomes on an annual basis. So everybody does it. And we get into a system of rights, a country without rights to receive social benefits, but responsibilities to pay for them. Yep. What's wrong is that you receive them, but you're not willing to even declare your income. You may not be taxed, right? A lot of people in many countries are not taxed because their incomes are too low. You set your tax threshold relatively high. But you need to develop a society where we have rights and responsibilities, and we understand that as citizens. But if we can do it on an incentive base to get people in, that's much better than an issue through a punishment base, right? You know, that you have to do it, you're going to be punished.
Carrot and stick.
Or you give them, or you could, or let me just add to what you're saying, which is you could kind of compel everybody to report by law, but give them the option with the signature of their four wives to pull out. to give up the protection, to give up the return. You're getting like a 3-4% real return on the Provident Fund. And, you know, here's your account, here's your investments abroad, here's your investments domestically. You want to give that up? Get all your wives to sign, okay, to agree, and they're not going to sign.
That's a whole other challenge by itself.
So there are very clever ways, and I think you're articulating clever ways to get people to do this on a kind of voluntary basis and see the value of this.
This is the stick bait form as you introduce is, for example, hey, you want to get a driving license. You want to buy a car. Hey, we don't have any record of any declarations of income, so you can't get a driving license in our country. You can't buy a car. Then that's the stick that you begin to bring in. But you change society in that way, but in a fair way, right? So everybody will then receive the benefit if they want, but they have to be willing to fund them. Yeah. Right? You can't have anything for nothing.
I mean, the thing you have in Malaysia, which makes you more of a high income than a middle income country. I just drove on the highway from the beautiful airport, beautiful highway. You see the public goods. This is part of people's income that's not probably being counted in a way as part of personal income. So Malaysia's per capita GDP is not as, the way it's being counted is not as high as it actually is. You go to the US and the infrastructure looks like it's in the third world. So we don't have the public goods that Malaysia has, and paying for that is a public duty. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's being mentioned here about a civic duty of, if you want to get a license, if you want to get a marriage license, we need to see your income tax return, because that's your civic, you know, responsibility to contribute to the public goods, which you're enjoying. And we need to protect your kids and your wife and your if your wife's at home or you if you're, you know, if your wife's working and you're at home watching the kids, that's all expensive, and you need to do your thing. You do your share.
Yeah, Hisham, do you think this is an obstacle? The fear or the apprehension that people in the informal sector have about declaring their income, about being part of the EPF system because they don't want to be taxed. So how much of a factor does this play in slowing down adoption?
I think quite a bit, because I think there's like what Dr. Kidd says, there's a lack of trust in the government. And when you don't trust the government, you don't tend to, you know, putting in an income tax file.
Is it also the simple question of people not having enough disposable income and not wanting to put aside money on top of the trust issue?
Which is true as well. But the reality is that something like 80% of Malaysians don't earn enough to pay tax anyway, right? So there shouldn't be an issue of putting in your income tax return and then having to pay tax on top of that. For most people, it doesn't apply. Mm. So it goes back, I think, more to that issue of trust. The fact that I'm contributing money, I don't know where it's going to, right? And I don't know what it's being spent on. And I think I get that a lot, that feedback a lot. You know, I'm not keen on paying tax because I don't know what the government is spending it on. Yeah. Right?
But if you make contributions on behalf of the poor and the disabled and the unemployed, unless they sign up, and signing up requires reporting their income, they'll lose the subsidy. And then if you send them annual reports, or if actually since the fund is invested in the same way for everybody, which is just brilliant, that's the Singapore, the brilliance of the Singapore model. You're not, you know, having this person having this advisor paying a huge fee like we have in the U.S. through our 401k system where, you know, Wall Street is making a mint off of the system. Everybody so all they have to do is look up. They know their beginning of the year balance. They know how well the fund's done. They can calculate how much money I've got. Yeah. It's not like you have to send an annual report every 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But if you send a report once a year, or let them go online and see how much, it doesn't have to be a physical report because you're giving them the cell phones, right? Yeah. We're giving you the cell phone so you can participate and you can see your savings grow. Mm-hmm. So I think this connection, is connecting your contributions to what you've got everywhere. This, you know, I'm contributing part of my pay so I have a healthcare system I can depend on when I get sick. Getting that message across over and over again, that and I'm contributing to the highways, and this is my property.
But I think it comes back to this idea, right? We all think it's the government giving us this, it's the government giving us that, the government gives us this. No, it's not, right? The government's only taking our money as citizens and redistributing it in ways that we as citizens think are right and fair. That's what a good government should do. And we have to get away from thinking that, hey, government's giving us this, government's giving us. No, they're taking our money, they're redistributing it, they're giving it back to us, and they should do what we as a society feel is the right way to do it.
I guess
it's a very different way of thinking. We all think it's the government. No, the government doesn't have any wealth apart from the wealth that we as citizens give to that government.
Yeah, I guess the predominant mentality in Malaysia is if I'm going to fork out money, extra money, I'm going to take a chunk of my paycheck every month. And you talk about social protection. Is where will that money go, and what will that money do to protect me when I'm retired or when I am having a tough period? So I guess that's the barrier, right? Because just like you mentioned, people don't see. If I'm taking 20% out of my paycheck, I don't see where it's going. So what motivation do I have to do that?
Exactly.
I'd say, look, ideally, let's say you're starting from scratch. You put in 25%. It's invested, let's say, just abroad, not in Malaysia. And you have an individual account. So you can look online every day, here's my money, and when I'm retired, is it paid out as an annuity? Is that how it's paid out?
No, it's currently, we're trying to go to a regular payout, but at the moment they have access to the whole thing.
So just like a constant flow?
We're trying to do a constant flow, but right now what the members do have the right to take all of it at once.
A lump sum.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I would eliminate that because you don't want people then showing up poor.
Yeah.
But this idea, look, it's being invested, and as you get older, it's conservatively invested, and we're going to take out, you know, if you're 60 and you could live to 100, we're going to take out a 40th. And when you're 61, we'll take out a 39th. Mm-hmm. And just make it so clear and transparent that they see that they have, that it's their money.
But I think the challenge is, right, invest in building your contributor system. How many, you know, when you've still got an 80% coverage gap in your pension system, it's going to take a lot of years.
Yes.
Right? So what are you going to do now? Right? Because, you know, for your pension, people need a pension now in Malaysia, and it needs to go forward.
So when you say 80%, is that a generational thing where the current retirees are 20% coverage?
This is the current over 65s, only 20%.
But if you go to like 30-year-olds, how much or what's the coverage rate there?
No, it's the coverage, but the at the moment, the Provident Fund isn't providing a pension. It provides a lump sum payment, so you don't actually get a pension. So the Provident Fund is looking at trying to annuitize or bring in other forms or social insurance within the Provident Fund because there still isn't a pension system there. However, right, these things are not that difficult to resolve because other countries have given everybody an old age pension within a few months. Mm. Just to give one example, I'm not saying you should necessarily do it. Take the fuel subsidy. You take 20% away from the fuel subsidy, right? So there'll be a slight increase in fuel prices, which is probably a good thing with climate change. We want people to be using less fuel.
Not a popular thing.
No.
Unless
were then to give out of that money, you could give everybody over 65 in Malaysia a relatively decent old age pension. You could do it within 6 months or a year. And now that might, people might say, hey, that's worth taking 20% off because everybody's going to benefit from that, even the people who are looking after the older people. So you have choices in Malaysia, right? You have choices. And the fuel subsidy is a big opportunity, right? To use that much better, particularly in the context of climate change. And that's a solution. A government who did that, you may say it's potentially unpopular. I say a government that does that is potentially winning the next election, right? In Malaysia, right? So let's have a look at that. And I think there are possibilities, right? There are radical possibilities that are not particularly radical, right, to do, because lots of other countries in Asia
it's just different,
are doing it. It's just a different way of thinking from the model that Malaysia's followed up to now.
Kind of a balance between this kind of pay-go tax people and use it to pay to people who are going to vote for me versus thinking longer term about the next generation and making sure we have a generational compact where we're not expropriating younger people to the benefit of... I realize that, you know, if you only have 18% coverage, you have a lot of poor old people. So there's an issue there about a basic benefit that they need. But let me just give you one quick illustration about what happened in Norway, real quick. So the reason they have a Provident Fund, from my understanding, is actually connected to me, because I started something called Generational Accounting. We went to Norway. It looked like they had a big government surplus. They didn't have a debt. And it looked like they were in great long-term shape, but it turned out that they were spending at such a high rate that the implication was that their kids and grandkids were actually going to be facing very high taxes. It was just the accounting was screwed up. You had to look at everything, the off-the-book, the on-the-book liabilities, and see the long-run picture. And once they saw that, they started doing this analysis in-house, fiscal gap and generational accounting. They went to the Provident Fund. So you may be looking at the father of the Norwegian Provident Fund. I don't know for sure if I'm over, you know, claiming credit, but that's what I've been told by Norwegian economists that I work with.
Right. Gentlemen, I apologize. We just have a few minutes left, so I want to return to Hisham, talking about people's trust towards the institution and them seeing the returns of their investment.
Right.
As you know, EPF dividends. So what do you think the main upside and downside risks going forward, and how do you plan to manage this?
Well, the way we design our asset allocation is that we try to overcome any of the upturns or downturns in the economy, right? But the whole idea is to provide a consistent stream of income to our members. So the way the asset allocation is designed is to make sure that we limit the downside as much as possible for an acceptable level of risk. And that does include, as Professor Kolarikov said, quite a bit of international investment, and that's something that we're going to continue to increase over time. So, you know, markets are markets. They go up and down. We do the best we can, but, you know, there's no guarantees. The risk is always there. But we've done as much as we can to limit the variability as much as possible.
Okay. Dr. Kidd, on a broader picture, Malaysia is also facing a challenge in increasing and diversifying its revenue base to accommodate a lot of these policies, or maybe even implement some of the newer policies that you mentioned before. So I guess this is one of the underlying problems, I guess, because we just have a finite amount of money that we can use. So the grand goal has always been to expand that our coffers so that we can do more. So considering our industries, the makeup of our economy as a developing one, albeit close to a developed nation, how does the country continue to ensure healthy economic growth and healthy diversification of revenue moving forward in this global economy?
Well, I think it comes back to the point I was making almost at the beginning. It's around building a strong social contract, building trust in government, getting people to be, you know, understanding that, yeah, if we pay our taxes, we're going to get something back. And then this idea that there's a fixed budget, right, a fixed pie, disappears, right? Because that can grow over time, which is what has happened in many countries. So you've got a very, very, very low tax level, right? It's what tax income? It's about 12% of GDP. It's tiny. You can't have a decent society on that. But it's important to recognize that as you invest in your people through greater social spending, if it's well designed and delivered, you're going to help your economy grow as well.
In other words, it would accrue more and more debt.
No, because if your revenues are increasing, you'll be able to pay off your debt. So you compare, you know, this, you know, let's say Finland, Sweden, etc. After the Second World War, were at a similar level of government revenues, right? 20% or less. Sweden was about 12%, right? At the end of the Second World War, it grew that over the next 2 to 3 decades to up to around 50% of government revenues in of GDP. Was government revenues. It did that slowly by building this trust in government. And that's the fundamental issue, is how do you build trust in government? But government has to behave well, right? But government's also got to be, you know, brave enough to make some of the difficult choices, you know, in terms of doing it. And I think, you know, we had a presentation this morning about the world is burning, right? The world is burning. You know, we don't have much time to change things. We've got to do something. Things like a fuel subsidy are not part of what a modern economy should be doing, right? We need to be removing that. We need to be discouraging people from getting into their cars. We need to be building public transport systems. We need to go green. We need to have electric cars. So you need a shift from, and you need to educate the population to not be dependent on a fuel subsidy, which is a form of social protection that benefits the rich and not the poor, right? So it's a very unfair form of social protection. And shift it round to something where it can be done and investing in your population, building the skills of your population, building your workforce, and doing things like we were talking last night. The minimum wage in Malaysia is way too low. Salaries are way too low. You need a seriously decent living minimum wage that people can, you know, be delivering, that employers can deliver. You need a higher wage economy in Malaysia. There's a lot of things to be done. The big advantage that Malaysia has over many other countries is you're a relatively wealthy country. You have the option to make these choices. And this idea that there is a fixed budget is never correct. That there's a fiscal constraint, there's a political constraint, there's not a fiscal constraint in Malaysia.
I think before you spend any money, make sure you're spending it wisely. Yeah. And that's one of the things you've done is the money you have been spending, you've been spending wisely, and it showed off. I mean, think about early childhood investment education. You're ranked like 34th. Norway's ranked number one. The level, relative to the scale of your economy in Norway is twice as high, but you're also, you know, not delivering it. That's a great place for investment. So if you're going to, you know, tax and spend, let's do it where there's a big payoff.
Right.
Think about making Malaysia the most attractive place in the world for Russians who want to leave, or are highly educated who want to leave that oppressive country.
Be rewarded, people. You're getting good education. But if they're not going to get good wages in the Malaysian economy, they're going to be leaving, and you're going to be bringing in low-wage workers from elsewhere, and that sort of way. So you have to have a good education, and you have to have a good labour market that's delivering decent wages to people.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
government has a role in influencing that.
We have a few minutes left, so talking about spending your money wisely on an individual level, Hisham, EPF just also recently launched the Belanjawanku app.
Yeah.
To help families plan their finances better. So what can you share with us about this app before we end?
Okay, so we've been working with this with University of Malaya for a few years now. So basically it's a reference budget. It's the minimum amount that you need to achieve minimum quality of life in different areas of the country. So we started with KL. We expanded it to, we now have something like 12 different cities in Malaysia.
Right.
And you'll see different levels of expenditure depending on what your household composition is. So we took that data, we put it into a budgeting app. So what that does is that, you know, you input all your particulars and it'll give you a recommended minimum level of expenditure that you should have to achieve a particular standard of life. And we hope to build on this work going forward to include retirement calculators, you know, financial objective calculators, so that you know, our members actually have the tools to not only understand, you know, how much they need to spend, but also how much they need to save, and you know, what kind of savings do they need to actually achieve particular financial goals.
Right. Yeah. Thank you, Hisham Hussain, Chief Strategy Officer of EPF, also Dr. Stephen Kidd, Senior Social Policy Analyst for Development Pathways, and of course, Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, Professor of Economics at Boston University. And thank you so much to you for watching Agenda Awani. We'll see you in the next episode. Goodbye, and until then.